Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Evelyn Dulsaver, a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and your moderator for the program. Now, to learn more about our events and membership on or traveling with the Commonwealth Club, please visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest, Professor Juan Triana. For the last 3 years, Juan has been a professor of economics at Havana University and the Polytech Institute of Havana. He teaches political economy to undergraduate students and macroeconomics to graduate students. He's one of the first economists to write about the private sector and its implications for Cuba. And Juan has published papers on the topic for the Observatory of the Latin American Economy, the World Bank, as well as other Cuban economic magazines. He's also served as an economic advisor for several small Cuban companies. And many of us, of course, have heard him speak while we visit Havana on our club's trip to Cuba. So we're really pleased to have him here in the U.S. This is his first trip to the U.S. He's had a whirlwind visit, and he'll tell you a little bit about that. And today's his last official duty, so the rest of the time he's going to be enjoying California. So he'll speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll remain at the podium, or we'll sit over here at the table for Q&A. One.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much. I'm not used to use this kind of a microphone, so thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of being here talking to you and bringing some insights of the Cuban economy, of the last reforms in the Cuban economy, how that is going, and, of course, with a previous background about what we did some years ago. So, as you can see in the title, I have a question there I will try to answer very fast at the end of the presentation. Those are about 15, 12, 17 slides, no more than that, 25 minutes talking. I will begin talking about the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, how we did some things there, and how what we did those years have become one of the most important assets for the ongoing reforms we are issuing right now in Cuba. Okay? So, at the very beginning, I would like to talk about the triumph of the Cuban Revolution and the breakpoint of the relations between Cuba and U.S. This is something that I will always like to remind everyone because it's the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, 1959, and it's the beginning of the transformation of the Cuban economy and the Cuban society. And, of course, the relations between our two countries had a huge impact on what Cuba did after 1959, okay? So at the very beginning, we must understand that Cuba didn't went into socialism that deep, that far. I mean, in fact, when we triumphed 1959, the Cuban economy was quite a popular and democratic revolution trying to achieve for the population many demands they were asking for years before, I mean, since 1940 with the Constitution of Cuba of 1940. So the Cuban revolutionary movement in 1955, they designed a program of six important economic and social reforms that they will be running once they got into power. Those were mainly about education, healthcare, racism, gender discrimination, industrialization of the country, and some other important reforms that, in fact, was the one that Cuban government start issuing in 1959. What happened? By those years, as many of us know, Cuba was under the control mainly of the United States. More than the 75% of the Cuban business belonged to very strong American companies and just a tiny part of Cuban wealthy businessmen. And almost the 90% of the Cuban land was owned by some American companies. In that way, it was very hard for Cuba after the first 6-9 months to keep running those reforms they were trying to run by those years. So what they did was just turning back to the American businessmen and asking, okay, this is a new government, we have new rules, and if you want to stay here, do you want to stay here? Well, you have to go to through our new rules. And that's what we did. I mean, the American government was paying very bad, very low taxes to the given government. They had a very solid and nice, attractive contract with the previous president of Cuba, the dictator Batista, And they were bribing many authorities, many officers in the very high levels of the government. That's why they were allowed to do many things in Cuba. So the Cuban government says, well, from now on, these are new rules, and you have to go under which if you want to remain here in Cuba. They say no. They went out with all the technology and the qualified personnel, and Cuba left by those years with no one to run those companies, with no technology, with no qualified personnel. So the only, I mean, after that we have Bay of Pigs. We all know what happened in 1961 in Bay of Pigs, and then 1962, the missile crisis, you know. After that, I mean, that was a very hot point in our relations between the two countries. And after that, the only help we got was coming from the USSR. This sympathetic help they had, and they want to show us. I mean, of course, we all know they have a huge political interest behind, but it was the only country that came to Cuba to help us, and we really need someone to help us, you know, that we can move forward and continue with the with all the reforms we were running. That's why the USSR came to Cuba to buy about 20.4 million sugar tons for $3 billion. And then when some Cuban people high in the government, like Che Guevara, like Fidel, and some others, embraced the socialism as the most important line to follow for the Cuban Revolution. There were many fair reasons for this. And that's why we start doing 1961, at the end of 1961, the beginning of 1962, trying to build socialism in the Cuban Revolution. So we start doing some things in order we can achieve that by 1962, 1963. And here are the most important things we did during the first 30 years. First of all, we designed three development strategies based on the help we were obtaining from the USSR. First of all, one strategy from 1963 to 1965 that was a development strategy of the quick industrialization of the country. We realized we had no industries in Cuba. Everything we had was to produce raw material to export it to the United States so they can do a very fancy product and export it to Cuba and we buy it from them. So we decided to do this. What happened? By those years, Cuba has no resources to do that. So we focused everything we were obtaining from the USSR to this strategy. After that, we run the agricultural development strategy. And then from 1977 to 1989, a kind of diversification development strategies. At the same time, we try to develop the industry, and at the same time, we try to develop the agricultural sector in Cuba. The most important characteristic we had by those years, in order we can achieve this, was that we had a state-run economy because we had a total centralization of the decisions and the economy in Cuba. Everything was decided by the top levels of the government, and we eliminate all the private property from the Cuban economy. 1968, I mean, we nationalized the big American companies like United Fruit Company, AT&T, American Sugar Company, and many others, up to 150 companies in 1960. October 1960 was the last one about. And in 1968 in Cuba, until 1968 in Cuba, remained many small and private businesses. But the Cuban government decided that those private businesses, in order that the socialism we were building become effective, those must not continue in the Cuban economy. So we run what we call the revolutionary offensive. And we expropriate more than 48,000 private businesses in Cuba, and we eliminate totally from Cuban economy the private property. Okay, so what we had was social property run by the state totally until 1989. The result, we must look at them economically and socially speaking. Economically, we can say that all these strategies were not very successful, not even one of those. I mean, we were able to build more than 150 sugar mills and to renovate and improve the technology in those 150 sugar mills with USSR technology. We were able to produce very attractive levels of many agricultural products in Cuba by those years. And we were able to develop more our industry than what we have before 1959. But we didn't reach the levels we were supposed we had set years before. That's why we can say these strategies didn't succeed by those years. And the problem is that socialist speaking, and this is something very important, the Cuban government, they were trying to develop our economy, but at the same time, they were very focused on what? On achieving very high levels in terms of social programs. For example, illiteracy in the Cuban economy, in the Cuban society in 1959 was about 92%. We're talking about 6.8 million people, 92% of illiteracy. In 1960, the Cuban Revolution decided to run this literacy campaign, and we achieved 99% of literacy, talking about sixth grade. Up to 1989, all the Cuban citizens had at least ninth grade, 1989. Cuba was very focused also by those years in trying to grant to the population a free universal healthcare system, because the problems with the healthcare system we had before 1959 were that huge that the, for example, Cuban women had to have about 8, 9, 10 children to see how many of them achieve 30, 40, 50 years old, because the condition was very hard by those years. Family planning was something that didn't exist before 1965 in Cuba. Those were things that the Cuban government was trying to include in the mind and the philosophy of living of the population by those years, and those were the highest achievements of the Cuban government by those years. I mean, they were focused mainly on the social part of our society than on the economical part. Okay, this happened until 1989. We really advanced pretty much in comparison with the last of the Latin American countries in the first 30 years of the Cuban Revolution. I mean, it was so fast that we left behind almost all the Latin American countries, including Brazil, including Argentina, including Mexico, including Costa Rica, in terms of social indexes. Okay? But then the 90s came, and with the 90s, I mean, also came, I mean, the beginning of the deepest economic crisis that Cuba have ever faced. I mean, we all remember the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990, the collapse of the Mutual Economic Help Organization. Those were the only two economic partners of Cuba by those years. I mean, more than 98% of our trade was happening with the Western socialist countries, with the Soviet Union. And when they collapsed, I mean, first of all, Cuba always... We always think that the USSR were going to last forever. So we decide to develop, as I told you, a bit our economy and mainly focus on the social programs, because what we were obtaining from the USSR was so much that we didn't need to produce those in Cuba, because the USSR were going to last all the time we need them. So we never think that that collapsing was going to happen, and... We never thought that debt collapsing was going to happen in 1990, just 30 years after we triumphed. And that just got us very rapidly. We were not prepared for that. We were not self-sufficient, I can tell you, in any area. So Cuba faced a very hard times by those years. And, I mean, the GDP went down to 34.7%. We lose more than the 78% of our trade. And the conditions of living, of the life in Cuba... was critical. I mean, here you have, for example, you can see this is the behavior of the GDP and the inflation just from 1989 to 2011. You can see how grow the inflation in Cuba, how down went the GDP. That is, that relation tells you how critical was the relation between the what we call the purchasing party power of the currency. What is the relation between the nominal salary and the real salary? I mean, people still earning exactly the same they were earning in terms of nominal salary in 1980, but what they can afford with that money was just nothing. I mean, a cigarette box in Cuba went from 7 Cuban pesos to 150 Cuban pesos, just to have an idea about how hard that was. We also must remember that the intensification of the blockade in 1992 under the Torricelli Act and 1996 with the Helms-Burton Act and the Clinton administration just created a huge supply deficit for the Cuban economy, because that stopped us from trading with the rest of the world and stopped the rest of the world of trading with Cuba. So we left alone by those years. We were not able to produce anything. And one of the strongest responses of the government by those years was to decentralize decisions in the economy, betting for the private sector, trying to encourage the private sector by the decree law 141 of 1993, trying to lease land to the people so they can produce, trying to develop the tourism industry instead of the sugar industry due to the fall of the international prices of sugar that was the main industry in Cuba by those years. And the result of those reforms in the 90s led to the result that Cuba started growing in 1996. We start growing in 1996 about 2.3%, which is not pretty much, and that is when we point the Cuba recovery of the crisis. We have been recovering of the crisis the last 23 years, so we are very. I could say that we are not very good recovering of the crisis, but we are very good managing economic crisis. So just going deeply now into the beginning of the updating of the economic Cuban model, which is the last reforms that Cuba is issuing just right now, I would like to say why the first 30 years of the Cuban Revolution have become the base of the ongoing reforms and how the needs becomes a right and transform into a given social gain. What this means? It means that the most important assets Cuba has right now to run the reforms that Raúl Castro is running since the last 7 years are those that we built from 1959 to 1989, and even during the first years of the 90s. And those are, first of all, the very high qualified personnel we have been forming since the last 40 years. I mean, all that Cuba invests in education in the first 30 years have become the most strongest asset Cuba has right now. And we're talking about the educational system. Cuba is graduating about 10,000 people of the university every single year. We're talking about we are graduating about 3,000 doctors every single year. People that have, they might not be able or use to work with the very fancy equipment that some developed countries has every single year in the practice. But these personnel, these Cuban doctors, professionals, physicians, are very used to handle. I mean, they have very high qualification and used to handle with very important diseases, and they have very good results in comparison with the Latin American countries and many developed countries in the world right now. One of the most important programs are also the healthcare system. Cuba is graduating, as I told you, 3,000 physicians. We have right now about 24,000 physicians and professors working in Venezuela, more than 1,500 working in Brazil, more than 1,000 working in Angola. And in many other places, Cuba has more than, between the rest of the country, we have more than 2,000 physicians working there. These have become the most important income source of Cuba. About from $8.5 billion Cuba is obtaining every single year. For example, last year from the exportation of the professional services, $5.4 belongs to the physicians. So, and all these people we are exporting are not people that are 20 years old. We're talking about physicians of 45, 50 years, 52 years, 42 years, people that were educated in the last years of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s. So people that have been benefit with those first investment of the Cuban Revolution in education, in biotechnology, and in the healthcare system. Then we have the sport and the social programs. This is some of the most important programs that Cuba is running right now, answering to the demands of the population. What happened? This updating of the Cuban economic model, first of all, is based, as I told you, in those social gains that we have, those social gains that have become the identity of the Cuban Revolution and is the main line of what we call the guidelines of the reforms. I mean, in 2008, the Cuban government came out with this idea of updating the Cuban economy. I mean, the last 2 years of Fidel, the first years of Raúl. And they said that in order to start running these reforms, the most important thing was answering to the demands of the population. So we had from 2008 more than 1 million meetings in the whole country at all levels, from the circumscription to the municipalities to the province to the central level, in every school, in every university, in every hospital, in every job. People get together to discuss what were the most important things where we need to create and to implement reforms. All those demands were gathered, processed, and loaded to the central level in order they can create what we call the guidelines of the reforms, which have become the program of the ongoing reforms, 313 points that touches every single point of the Cuban economy. And for example, our base, and right now one of the most popular are the one inside the sport field and inside the construction. People right now in Cuba, this is very popular, people right now in Cuba are allowed to build their own houses. People are allowed to ask credit to rebuild, repair their own houses, to sell their own houses, to improve their quality of life. And, I mean, for example, what you see here is a tourism bus that is working in Cuba. It's one of the most important things where the reforms are being focused right now in tourism, which is the third income source of Cuba by this moment. Here you have some achievements of the reforms. You have, first of all, a new balance of the property structure. This is something brand new, something that 15 years ago you weren't able to listen into the Cuban economy. Our president came out about 5-6 years ago, and he says in national television that the Cuban government was focused on set a new balance inside the property structure of the Cuban economy. But this time it was going to be 40% in favor of the state-controlled businesses and 60% in favor of the private businesses. Many people could say, well, 60% in favor of the private property is not too much. But if we take an account that in 1989 and 1990, the beginning of the crisis, the 99.9% of the Cuban property was state-run, the Cuban businesses were state-run, and in 1996, after the decentralization and the new reforms during the crisis, about the 98% remained under the state control. What we have right now here is huge. I mean, only 40% being controlled by the government and 60% of the business being controlled by private people means a lot for Cuba. And then we have the massive land leasing. What happened? Cuba is importing right now $2.2 billion just in food. And we're not talking about apples or perhaps strawberries that we cannot grow in Cuba because of the weather. We're talking about rice. We're talking about chicken meat that we are importing from the United States. We're talking about wheat, corn. We're talking about powder milk, for example, that Cuba can easily produce in our country. So the problem is that, it's a trade-off. This very high education and qualified personnel we have in Cuba is working in two ways. Why? Because if you educate people too much and people achieve very high degrees, I mean, master degrees, PhDs, once you have finished studying for, 14, 15 years, of course, people would like to have a nice car, nice office in the top of the building. People won't go to the land to get their hands dirty to produce something. So if you have 11.3 million people as total population in Cuba and only 4.6 million people are the total labor force, and from those 4.6 million people, more than the 60% have those very high degrees, you have just a few people that may go to the land to work directly with the land. And if those people don't have, those 40% don't have PhDs, but they have university degrees, they wouldn't like to go either to work the land. So you have to create incentives so people can go to the land. One way to create incentives is giving them tools, equipment, tractors, trucks, processing machines, those things, very updated machines, so they can make the job more humanitarian. But Cuba does not produce that, and we are not able to import it because some blockade regulations. So you cannot use that as an incentive. The only way Cuba has right now to give us an incentive to the people is this land leasing. Important thing, it's not the same leasing that is where understand. People don't pay for the land in Cuba. You can ask as many land as you want, and you don't pay for the land at all. You can easily say, I want, 50 acres, and you're going to have the 50 acres as long as you produce in the land, as long as you work the land and you produce something, okay? And you don't have to pay anything for that, and you can have contracts for 25 years, 25 years, 50 years, and you can renovate it at the end of those contracts without any problem. And you can have very interesting, very attractive contracts with the government or with some private cooperatives that are being created in Cuba since the last 2 years. The other achievement we have is the opening of the private sector in Cuba since 2010. I mean, October 2010, Cuba is just trying to encourage the private sector. We have a lot of restaurants. I mean, the people that of you that have been going to Cuba, I'm sure you have been visiting La Guarida, El Litoral, San Cristobal, and many other paladars that we have in Cuba. We have become very good, unique in these restaurants, spotless, very good food, very high quality. And for example, the Cuban government is also allowing people to hire, I mean to rent state locals. The government is saying, we are going to encourage the private sector. How? Well, we're going, first of all, to allow them to rent government facilities, infrastructure. We're not going to sell them those facilities because we must keep the control of the land, but we're going to rent them those places. We're going to create this administration contract for them that will last for 25 years, and they have the right to renovate it as many times as they want. And we cannot take their hands inside their businesses until the contract is done. That's why we have many people going into the private sector. For example, what you're seeing here, that is the May 1st parade. I mean, the Workers' Day, as we call it in Cuba. It's a huge parade in the Revolution Square where more than 1.5 million people goes every year, workers, unions. And that this big board you have here is the first time we have a union of private workers walking in the parade. First time in life they are represented in Cuba. That means a lot. That's why you can see that they have been growing from 2010 to 2014 more than 300%. We went from about 131,000 private workers in Cuba to 498,000 private workers just in 2 years. In Havana City, from 36,000 to 132,000 private workers. That is a huge, an explosive reaction. That is an exponential growing of private workers in Cuba that unfortunately is also working in 2 ways. I mean, many qualified people is just quicking from the public sector where we really need them, those skills, and moving to the private sector just because it's about 2,400 times more profitable. This is something the government is trying to solve. This is something the government have been trying to solve in the last 2 years. Hasn't been very effective, I can tell you so, but at least they have been doing some baby steps in this regard. I think it's going to be even better in the next 3-4 years. And also, we have the new Foreign Investment Act. This is something very interesting. This is something that has just lowered Cuba to the very top in the international arena because many companies in the world, foreign countries, have been interested to invest in Cuba in the last 2 years. We passed this act last March 30, 2014, and it's very attractive for foreign investors. First of all, They are allowed not to pay taxes for the using labor force for the first 8 years in Cuba. That is huge. I mean, if you compare this new Foreign Investment Act with the last one, that means a lot. And also, these foreign investors, for the first time, are allowed to repatriate the 65% of the profit to their countries after the end of the year. Before, they only were allowed to repatriate the 30%. After that, we also, I mean, another interesting thing is that Cuba, for the first time, allowed and make this as a regulation that between foreign investors and Cuban companies, all problems, legal issues that can be generated will be solved in international courts and not in Cuban courts as it were before. So the parts, the Cuban company, the Cuban government, or the foreign company must get together and agree in which court they're going to solve these issues under what kind of regulations, the European one or the American one, and they will solve it there. This means a lot for the foreign investors because, I mean, I can tell you, Cuba is not only a unique country, and many people really don't know about us in many areas, but if there is an area where they really don't know about it is the Cuban law. It's very hard, very complicated. So if you tell them, hey, all the problems are going to be solved in Cuba, they will say, well, I'm not going in because I really don't know how it works. But if you tell them every problem is going to solve in international courts, people will really go in because they really know how, I mean, because they will really know how the these legal issues are solved in the world. Here I also bring something important, which are the unsolved issues that have become some goals within the short term, I mean the next 3-5 years. And first of all is the most famous one, I think, is the one that many people are being asking for, and I think is also one of the most hard ones to solve in Cuba, is the dual currency system. So here you have, for example, this is Camilo Cienfuegos. He's the same one is down here. He's one of the heroes of the Cuban Revolution. It was Fidel, Camilo, Che, and Raul. And Cuban peso, CUP. Remember, CUP. And this is Cuban convertible, CUC. What do you always obtain when you go to Cuba and change dollars? Okay? And this is one of the most important problems that Cuba has right now in our economy. This is something that the Cuban government announced they were going to solve 2 years ago. This far, they haven't solved anything. They have been doing some things, just preparing the, preparing the terrain so they can solve it, doing some experiments. I will also like to say it's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing, not for the government and for some people in the government, even when some of them really don't know anything about economics. It's even harder for people inside academia, I can tell you, for professors, because implications here do not remain in the economic area. Goes farther than that to the population. And when you have 11 million people that are going to be affected because that reform, then you have to think about it very carefully. So the problem is, and I mean, we have to solve this. The government is trying to solve this because it's creating huge distortions for the Cuban economy. It's one of the things that is stopping the foreign investors of coming in Cuba, because there is no way to calculate how profitable is a company in Cuba when you have this dual currency system and you have a multiple exchange rate, informal exchange rate in Cuba, because the formal one is a fixed box, and people really don't know how that works. So it's very important to be clean in these terms, in terms of finances, so people can go in. It's some of the most important things we have to solve so we can attract more foreign investors, even when we are being very successful attracting them in the last 6-7 months. And, I mean, we can talk a bit about this during the Q&A time. Then we have some other reforms, I mean, some other unsolved issues, like the administrative restructuring. This is something very interesting because, I mean, the Cuban constitution is very old. I mean, the last time we did something in our constitution was 1992. And since 1992 to 2015, there have been about 23 years. And the Cuban economy and the Cuban society have been changing so much that if you don't change your constitution, then you're not going to be effective in any economical or social policy that you would like to run. So these is very important in order we can design all the administrative structures we have in Cuba right now, because the way they are working is very ineffective, is very bureaucratic, but not bureaucratic in the way Max Weber wrote about it, that bureaucracy was going to help government to run the country in a very successful way. It's just the other way around. Our bureaucracy is very bad. It's just making us very ineffective in every goal we set. And also because the Cuban population is not very used to respect the law. And this is something, for example, we have to learn from America. I have been realizing that American people are very respectful in terms of the law, something we have to learn, something that the Cuban government have to do in our country. Then you have the creation of institutions. This is something that is very important too. This is something that if you don't do it, then any regulation, any reform you would like to implement, like the one we are implementing right now, won't be successful. Why? Because the regulations and the reforms must have a kind of a structure to implement it, you know, and that structure are institutions. Institutions that are in charge of implementing at every level, vertically and horizontally, all those regulations. For example, if what we did just 6-7 months ago, we run a new labor code. Well, for the first time in this labor code is regulating the relationships between the private employees and the private employers. So an employee in the private sector cannot be fired just without a reason right now. The employer have to have a reason and must prove that. Okay? This is something very important. This talks about, it's answering to the rights of the employees. The problem is that these employees do not have any institution to go back and say, hey, he has fired me without a reason. Can you fight for me? So if you approve a regulation, if you approve a new labor code, and you want to run that, you need an institution to run that. Cuba right now have to update all our institutions based on our reality, not based on how institution works in the rest of the world, but based on our reality, based on the goals we have been setting in the last 3-5 years, and in the position that we want to see Cuba in the next 3-5 years. And the last one is the salary reform. Fortunately, this one already began in Cuba. The problem is that in order we can expand that salary reform in Cuba, we have to, I would like to say, having a better results, generally speaking, in terms of the Cuban economy. This already start into the biotechnological field in Cuba and the the doctors sector in Cuba. It is very easy to understand. We were obtaining $5.4 billion from physicians, from those professional services exportation, and they say we remain with the same salary. How is that if we are making all that money for the government? So the government says, okay, you're totally right. So we're gonna increase your base salary, and we're going to give you the opportunity of multiply your salary at the end of the month depending on how profitable have been the sector at the end of the month. The best place to see this is the biotechnological industry, where some people, for example, went from earning about 700 Cuban pesos a month as base salary to earn 1,000. Only 300 pesos. But 300 pesos in Cuba, which are about $12-$13, means a lot for Cuban people. And also these people have the opportunity to multiply their salary at the end of the month for 1.5, 1.7, up to 2.2, depending on the different categories they are, if they have PhDs, master degrees, if they don't have university degrees, and also depending on how well the company have been doing at the end of the month. Some people that were earning about 800 Cuban pesos 2 years ago, they are going to their houses at the end of the month in the last 15, 16 months with about 5,000 Cuban pesos every single month. So there is a huge achievement for the Cuban economy. I can tell you that. That is a huge achievement. People are being very optimistic about this. The problem is that in order you can move that to the rest of the sectors, those sectors have to do it very well as the biotech, as the doctors. If not, the rest of the economy have to do it very well together so they can use that benefits from some other sectors and put it in some others that are not doing it very well. To answer the question that we have in the title, capitalism or socialism, here you have some pictures, I'm sure everyone can recognize them. Well, we are not going into those places. We're not going to do anything they have been doing. What Cuba is going to do, I would like to say, in the next 7, 9, 10 years, I wouldn't dare to go farther than that, to forecast something farther than that, is building the Cuban socialism. This time, the Cuban socialism isn't going to be the same one we tried to build in 1961 when we copied the USSR economic model. But this time, we're not going to copy the Vietnamese model or the Chinese model or what the United States are doing or what England is doing, or not even what Venezuela is doing. This time, Cuba is trying to collect as many experiences as we can, mainly from Vietnam in some areas like agricultural, like rice producing and sugarcane producing, for example, something that Costa Rica have been doing in terms of tourism, like Brazil have been doing in terms of oil drilling, and like Norway have been doing in terms of social programs at the same time of economic development. So Cuba is trying to collect those experiences, and something very important, which I think is the key issue here, is trying to adapt that to the real Cuban conditions based on what we have every single year, not thinking that we have more than what we really have. Cuba is a very poor country in terms of natural resources, so we don't have that backup like many other countries. What we have is professional services, so we are linking our development to that very strongly and trying to use that to attract and trying also to use all the virgin sectors we have in Cuba to attract the foreign investment in order we can achieve about 6.5, 6.6 development growing rate in the next 3-5 years that would allow us to get over the crisis, the one that we went in 1990, in the next 10 years. That is what we are doing right now. And the most important thing, I mean, is the answer, as I told you, is the Cuban socialism and trying always to defend the social gains that we achieve during the first 30 years of the Cuban Revolution. Okay? Thank you very much. So, I'm sitting here now.
Okay, our thanks to Juan Triana, Professor of Economics at Harvard Havana University. I was saying Harvard. The Polytech Institute of Havana. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a lot of questions, so thank you for sending in those questions. And the very first one is around everybody really appreciates your honesty that you displayed here today, and they're wondering, does the Cuban government review your lecture materials, including this one?
I really don't go to any place for them to review my materials, but I say whatever I want in every place I want, in every place I am being invited, not outside Cuba, but inside Cuba. And yes, I can tell you the Cuban authorities, I don't know how, but they have all the means they need to know what I'm saying, and they do know what I'm saying. And what I really think is that, in Cuba you are free to say whatever you want. Perhaps not in the way we are free to say it right now. We weren't in the 90s or the 80s, but we were free to say whatever we want. The problem is that if you are good enough to sustain what you're saying with strong arguments, if you are good enough doing that and no one can refuse what you're saying, then you're going to have no problem. But if you're going to start saying many things, we have a logical line to follow, without strong arguments to defend your point of view, then you're going to have a problem. Every government set their own rules about what people can say, what people cannot say. Some governments are more free than some others. We have a history about not being so free like some others. But I think that at least inside my field, which is academia, people are quite free to say whatever they think as long as they can sustain that. And something interesting is that the government, the Cuban government, always valorate very high what professors have to say, even if they just disagree with the politics of the government. Unfortunately, there are some things that haven't been going in a very good way, like many other countries in the world, but most of them have been going in a very good way.
You answered this question, which the question was around what country does the Cuban government look to as a good model? And you, from what I understand, you're really talking about best practices from around the world adapted to the reality of Cuba. So along those lines, what additional reforms would you do if you were Raul today? What would you put in place?
That's a hard question, you know? I wouldn't like to be Raul, not now, not 5 years ago, not next 5 years, because being in that chair is like, having your shoes hot all the time, and then not good at all. About those experiences, yes, Cuba is trying to take experiences from different countries in different areas for each of those countries. I am very comfortable, I would like to say, with what the government is issuing right now. What I disagree on right now is in the way they have been issuing some things. The central guidelines of the Cuban development strategy, I think, are right enough for our times and for the next 3-5 years. The problem is the speed of those reforms in some areas that have been going too slow and in some others too fast. And the problem is the way you will implement those reforms, that in some of them are been going in a good way, But in many others have been going not in that good way, and that's why perhaps we haven't been able to achieve the results we were forecasting 3-5 years ago, perhaps because of that. I mean, the best example I think we have for that is the best two examples is the dual currency system and the foreign investment in Cuba. It's very important to solve that problem. The government have been pointing that since the last 5 years publicly, recognizing that this is one of the most important issues Cuba has to solve. And they have been saying, we are trying to solve it, but the way to solve it haven't been effective. So you're doing nothing if you say, we have to solve this, but you're not effective at doing it. The same happened with the foreign investment. We have been recognizing that we need about $2.5 billion. People inside academia, we think we need about $7 billion. And yes, the government ran a new Foreign Investment Act. We want people to come in. But the way we are trying to attract these people is not being effective. So one more time, I agree in identifying what are the most important lines in our development strategies. What I disagree on is the way to implement it. What I will change, if I would able to change it.
If you were king, what would you do?
If I would be able to change it, is the way to implement those reform. But I think I don't have pretty much more to add to those reforms. I think that for the short term, for the next 5-7 years of Cuba, those ones that we have been identifying are really fair.
Thank you. Well, one of the issues that we discuss a lot in the United States is income inequality. Mm-hmm. So how will Cubans deal with the possible higher income potential from tourism jobs, because they get tips and so forth, as we all know, we were there, then the professional jobs like the doctors who were starting to increase their wages, but certainly not to the level of some of the tips that were given out during the tourists.
Well, I would say that in every country in the world, this is one of the most important issues to solve. If we look deeply into Latin America, still a missing subject for the Latin American countries, even when we have a shift in our region, very interesting, growing at development levels in the last years, this income disparity have been something very hard to solve. And Cuba is becoming quite an important problem, not only because the growing of the tourism, also because of the encouragement of the private sector. People that work in the private sector, they have more money, they earn more money than the people that work in the public sector, which I can tell you is very important. We're talking about schools, we're talking about hospitals. So if you don't give incentives to people that are working, sorry, as professors or as perhaps physicians, then they will quit in that job and move to the private sector. So you will lose the labor force you need to sustain those social gains. Right now, I would say that the government recognized that that is a very important issue, that the government is trying to solve that, as I told you, with this salary reform. The problem is that the places where this salary reform began, which is biotech sector and physicians, are very profitable sectors in Cuba. And this is something interesting to understand. You can't pay to the people more money by printing money. If you print money, the result you're going to have is a supply deficit, first of all, and a huge inflation. That is the way the market has to reach a new balance. And we cannot handle a three-digit inflation like we did, or a supply deficit like we did in the 90s. If we go into that again, I think very bad things will happen in Cuba. So you cannot print money. And also, if you print Cuban pesos or convertibles, what are you going to do with them? You cannot buy anything abroad with them. It's just a piece of paper. And you can print dollars. I mean, we don't have the technology, even if we would like to do it. So the only way you have to pay more to the people is by obtaining more hard currency incomes. And those you obtain it through exportations or through foreign investment. Then you can pay more to the people. And I would say that as long as you keep healthcare system and educational system free for everyone, you're going to have a huge problem because they're not producing one single peso. You know, as Cuban people would like to say, free healthcare system and educational system is free for the people, but costs a lot to the government, which is something that people never see. The government have to invest a lot of money to keep that social gains. So in order that the government can pay more to the professors or more to the healthcare system, to the physicians, or more to the people that work in the foreign trade ministry, for example, that are public employees, the government have to use the benefit they are collecting from those profitable sectors and putting in those other sectors. That is the way they have right now. There are some other ways to do this that I think the government is just afraid to do it, which, for example, is allowing universities to develop industrial sectors to collect some money. Right now, I would say that is too soon to do that, and the government is kind of afraid to do it, but will be a very important potential way of incomes for the educational system in Cuba. The same time it happens with the healthcare system, for example. There is something that is very interesting, which is the medical tourism, something that Cuba have been very good at. If not, go to New York and you will see how many people are going to Cuba to get some surgeries and some other things, and then going to the Varadero and some other places to recover. Very nice way to recover. So if the government finally finds the way to implement those ways to develop that areas, then they will be able to pay more to the people. This far, I would say that we are prepared to do it in some areas. These are some of the things that I would disagree on the way the government is implementing some things. So these things are some of those that I will do right now. But I think the government is just afraid of doing it because they think that they will lose control in some areas. I also think there is a way to control everything by doing and not running the risk of not doing it, because it has a huge opportunity cost that will create even more distortions in the future.
Great. And you're listening, a reminder, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Juan Triana, professor of economics at Havana University and the Polytech Institute of Havana. Juan, what will be the impact, if you could think out 5 years from now and the negotiations between America and Cuba go well, what do you think Cuba will look like 5 years from now?
Well, I think we're going to still look in as a long island in the Caribbean. For sure. With a lot of American in. Yeah. I think so. First of all, I mean, it's very hard to forecast or to say something about this because we'll be speculating. There are many things, there are a bunch of things we have to take into account so we can say how Cuba is going to look in the next 3-5 years within the restoration of the Cuban and U.S. relations, or without the restoration of the Cuban and U.S. relations. First of all, we have to see what is going to happen with the America presidency. You have about 8 people running for presidency into the GOP, only one into the Democrats. We don't know who's going to take the chair. If it's one, I mean, if it's Hillary, well, she seems to be very pro-Cuba, pro-lifting the embargo. If it's Bush, which is, I think, the most strong candidate inside the GOP, he's not very pro-Cuba. Nevertheless, he's a very smart guy, and he wouldn't like to go back in some reforms and some things that Obama have been doing in terms of Cuba, because he will lose a lot of support, even within the GOP. So we have to see how that is going to result, in order we can say something about it. And then we have to see how Cuba is going to react to that, you know, because that is very important. You can right now lift the blockade. And if you do right now that, I mean, 2016, we can sunk into the middle of the Caribbean, you know, because we are not ready for that in terms of infrastructure, in terms of labor force. We're not ready
for that right now. We're not ready for that in terms of structure, in terms of regulations. So we have to move farther forward in that to prepare to what is coming. I think the way things have been happening in the last 7 months, which in my opinion is a huge achievement in comparison with the last 55 years, is quite okay. I mean, step by step, Obama have been granting some licenses to some businessmen in America to do business with Cuba gradually, like, for example, people exporting things to the private sector, like the American Airlines flying to Cuba directly, some of them. We're going to have JetBlue in July flying from New York to Havana City. And, for example, the ferries that will be in September going from Florida to Havana, only $300 per person with £200 free of charge, which means a lot. That, I mean, allowing American people going there under 12 categories without a special license and importing from Cuba $100 in tobacco and cigars, that means a lot for the next 3 months. We have to move farther than that. We have to solve some issues, I would like to say, politically, that are in the middle of succeeding in these relations. Some things that are just stopping us of restoring the diplomatic relations, like the Cuban adjustment law that America still implementing against Cuba, and some points inside the embargo and the diplomatic relations. But any point of view, you can see what is happening right now. The result is good. We rise 36% in terms of tourism, American tourism, in the first 5 months of 2015. 36% in 5 months. And you are not free to go yet to Cuba. Can you imagine? Once you are free, I mean, we forecast about 2.2 million American citizens going to Cuba, plus another million Cuban American. Those summarizing the tourism we have already, those should be about 6 million people going to Cuba. We don't have people enough.
No,
we don't have airport. We don't have roads. We don't have oxygen for that people. this is something very interesting because, I mean, we are 11 million people, so we're gonna have more than the half of our population as tourists in Cuba during the high season. And if, I mean, 11 million people, but we have to take in account that only 4.5, 4.6 million people as labor force. The other people are all people, because Cuban population is getting old and old and old, and just a few young people that can't work with tourists. So we don't have almost no one to work with that many tourists. But it's been very good. I can tell you it's been very good in terms of our relations. It's been very good in terms of the economical relations. And it's very, very good in terms of the economical relations of Cuba with the rest of the world. I mean, what is happening with America right now has such a big collateral impact in terms of commerce between Cuba and the rest of the world that, I mean, is helping us to move farther right now without the United States business community doing business with Cuba.
Great. Okay. We got a lot of questions, but we only have time for two more, and these are personal. I always like to end with the personal questions. So if it's not too personal, how old are you?
I am just a bit younger than many of you. Bit younger. 28 years, great. I'm going to be.
Great. And the other question is, how do you speak such great English?
Well, I have been always a huge fan of the music in English, like the Beatles or Billy Joe. And also the educational system in Cuba since 1990, when we turned from Russian to English, is mandatory for all Cuban students since sixth grade up to the second year into the university. You can't achieve a very high level, but the basic things, you will learn it, and then you can perform your and improve your language in some specialized schools we have around the country. And of course, if you really like it and you start reading and watching TV shows of like White Collar and The Big Bang Theory and many others,
and listening to some music, then you have the opportunity to improve it as much as you can. But many people, I mean, I can tell you almost every single Cuban people has, know how to say 10 words in English and communicate.
And I would love to hear, since this is your first visit to the United States, what's your impressions?
Well,
compared to what you expected.
Well, I would say that so far my trip to the United States, in all the institutions and all the universities, all the people I have been meeting, even the Republicans, have been very very good. I can tell you so. I have learned a lot. I have learned a lot. I tell you so. I have been able to bring up some insights about Cuba. I have been able to share some opinions with some congressmen about what is happening between our two Congress. Fortunately, with Republicans, I think it's the most important thing Cuban people have to try to do right now, talk with Republicans. The Democrat part, we have it almost solved. So I've been a total success right now. I would tell you so. I'm going back to Cuba with some future programs, very potential programs and interchange, where I would like to bring up here some other Cuban professors to share their point of views with American academia sector here in Cuba, with some businessmen. So this far, so far I think everything have been great. Let's see what's up in the next 15 days.
Right. So he's going to enjoy a Giants game tomorrow night, and then down to San Diego and Lake Tahoe. So he's getting a really nice taste of California. So our thanks to Juan Triana, Professor of Economics at Havana University and the Polytech Institute of Havana. And thanks to our audience here and those listening on the radio and online. I'm Evelyn Dilsaver, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.